Sometimes running a business can feel like swimming upstream in Siberia.
Welcome.
With a bear clinging onto your leg. But Xero Online Accounting Software can help you manage the ins and outs of your finances in real time, so you can keep them running smoothly. Soon it will feel more like you're going down a water slide.
Your turn.
In a rubber ring. Or being serenaded by a string quartet. Search Xero with an X, because healthy business is beautiful business.
Nerdy Show. A once great and powerful podcasting force now slumbers deep in the chasms of the internet. But, as was foretold, should any dare call upon its power, it will awaken once more and shine its insights and irreverence upon every facet of nerddom. I have but to speak the words. From comics and video games to science and technology, if it's geeky, we've got it covered. Welcome to Nerdy Show. Hi, I'm Kat. And if you're a longtime Nerdy Show listener and this episode is a surprise to you, then you clearly haven't listened to our previous episode, which came out just a couple days before this one. I highly recommend it, because not only will you get a taste of my new nerdy podcast series, Mother, She Wrote, but you'll get all the details on what's up with Nerdy Show at large. In this episode, we are speaking with a luminary of nerd music and a legend of chiptune music, none other than Matthew Applegate, a.k.a. Pixelhate. You may remember him from way, way, way back in 2009, Season 2, Episode 12, where we first interviewed him. Or maybe our other two interviews following that one. But it's been a while. You see, this podcast doesn't have a monopoly on going dormant for years. Why, 12 years ago, Pixelhate stepped away from music. He transformed from pioneering chiptune artist to a pioneering educator, and founded the Creative Computing Club, an institution that tutors young people in computer programming, video game design, hardware programming, electronics, and robotics. Which is rad. But no sonic wizard stays entombed forever. Pixelhate is back, baby! His new record, Hard Reset, is out now, and further new projects await. There's a lot to catch up on. The hows and whys of his departure and everything that happened in between is a wild story. What's more, in this episode, Pixelhate takes us through the new album, track by track, sharing crazy tales like how his first acting gig on the set of a Tollywood movie led him to programming a song on decommissioned missile hardware. In fact, there was so much to talk about that this episode is only one half of the interview. You'll find an expanded, alternate cut of our discussion with Pixelhate on my aforementioned show, Mother, She Wrote. It's a show about the Earthbound trilogy. You know, those weird Nintendo games. The ones that Ness and Lucas from Smash Brothers are from. Yeah, that series is so fascinating and deep that I've made a whole podcast about it. To that point, Pixelhate joined us on Mother, She Wrote to discuss the first game in that series and the revolutionary chiptunes work that went into it, which pushed the NES to the limit of what it could do sonically. All this is to say, yes, do check out both versions of this interview, but also that I'm not alone in this discussion. I'd like to introduce to you my wife and co-host of Mother, She Wrote, Jessica Mudd, who's joining me for this interview.
Hi, Nerdy Show. I'm thrilled to be here, but I regret to inform that I can't promise as many poop jokes as Brandon.
An aspiration I dare say none of us can ever hope to meet. A true legend.
Yes, Brandon is to poop jokes what Pixelhate is to chiptunes.
And yet only one of them has a Wikipedia page. What a crime. Join us, won't you, as we learn more about the various eras of chiptune music, Pixelhate's reclamation and repurposing of computer chips from dying consoles, and his return to the music scene with his new record, Hard Reset. Pixelhate, welcome back to Nerdy Show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's been a long time since you've been on the show, and you and the genre of chiptunes have been on one heck of a journey.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could give us a recap of the genre and your career so far.
I started very informally in about 88, 89.
Wow.
My baby sister came into my bedroom. I was playing on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on the NES. She came in, wanted, you know, me to do something. I can't remember what. and she smashed my Nintendo with her baby bottle. She was only two. She was running around the house and she hit it, knocking it on the floor, dislodging the cartridge and making the noise just go freeze. Like you can get that sometimes. Mm-hmm. It goes, doo. And I was quite into hip hop music at the time and sampling. And obviously, if you go back and listen to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, it has quite good bass on it.
It does.
Because it uses the triangle wave quite prominently. And that got me thinking, oh, that's quite interesting. I never considered the NES as making music, just video game music in the past. So I very dangerously popped it open and just kept whacking a screwdriver inside of it while it was turned on and making it freeze up and making it jam at different points and sampling that with my friend Roddy. His dad was a professional radio DJ and he had one of those early samplers with those, they have sort of video shows with terrible sound effects mm-hmm. when somebody says something cheesy and something triggers off. Well, we just loaded it full of NES samples of me freezing stuff. We were doing terrible rap songs over NES samples, but it got me thinking about how to use these machines as musical instruments as opposed to just kind of things that you play on. And I think that was what, in my head, what I class as the first wave of chiptune music is that we're taking the notes that somebody else has already put into a machine and kind of hacking them a bit and sampling them and turning them into music. And it went away for a bit like most things do. I didn't really think about it. I realized I couldn't rap very well, so I thought I'd put that to the side and move on. I joined like a really bad cover band. I was in an REM cover band. We were awful.
Oh, what were you called?
We were called ERM. quite literally, when I phoned up and spoke to the promoter for our first gig, I suddenly realized we didn't have a name. And when he asked me, so what's your band? I said, and he ripped down ERM. So we were on the poster. It's ERM.
He said, well,
I thought you were an REM cover band. I was like, we are, but we're not I don't know what we are. But then we were ERM for a while. So then we just went with it. But I really love the orchestration in REM songs. Like Night Swimming, all of those. I really, really loved it.
Yeah.
I couldn't afford an orchestra, no surprise, because I was a teenager in 1994, 95. And I used a thing called Deluxe Music Construction Set on the Amiga 500, which was bloody awful. I learned that I could take the Amiga 500 and put it through a Zoom guitar pedal to add reverb to the strings it to sound a bit fuller. To make it sound a little bit more interesting. And then, you know, I got more and more involved in electronic music. You know, people like Bjork was coming out, Aphex Twin was coming out. I got more into trackers and those awful samplers on the Amiga 500. I've just dug out so many bad songs from when I was younger. It's brilliant. but I liked the Amiga and I liked sampling, but I really, really missed the simplicity of pulse waves on the NES and stuff like that. Because my childhood was spent in arcades. We don't have those really anymore. We have these weird things that they just have like a few machines in a bowling alley somewhere. And everything is prize orientated. If you play on an arcade machine, it's always about getting tokens. So I was like, no, it's about actually playing the game.
It's about going on an adventure, damn it.
Yes. Right. It's about hearing the chaos. My girlfriend hates arcades because she says it's got loads and loads of noises and sounds in it. Like, that's exactly why I love it, because I love to clash all the different sound waves and stuff like that. So when I got a PC and I had the ability to almost produce any sound imaginable, I thought, I don't want to do that. I want to actually go back and learn about all the historical machines. I want to learn about all the machines that I missed, because I traveled from England to America, back to England. And in that swap over period, I missed a lot of interesting machines. We over here had probably about 60 different home computers. In America, I think you had like the Commodore 64 and Apple II and a few others. But over England, we had like everybody in their garage was chucking out their own homemade computers, which was brilliant. So I used the PC and the internet to go back and actually learn about all these different machines and start actually writing software for that. So that's my kind of second wave, where I start writing the software on the devices. Like the Game Boy, I wrote a cartridge for that, Game Boy Advance, Nintendo DS, and so on. I just started writing my own software and making music from that, because I don't master my albums. I don't add EQ. I don't put any effects on it. If I want to have like an echo, I will repeat the note again and again at lower volume.
Heck yes. That's a really authentic use of the hardware, making sounds within the scope of the original instruments. So that takes us to the mid-aughts, and by then the term chiptune is coming into use. The retro chip sound is gradually returning to music and pop culture at large. Your first full-length chiptune album, Video Games Ruined My Life, came out in 2006. You released two more records in 2007 and 2009. And you and your software are forces at the forefront of the genre. So what happened next?
I kind of got to a point, I think, around 2009, 2010, where I thought I kind of hit the glass ceiling of chiptune music, if there was such a thing, in that I had gone from literally my dining room table to performing at the Brighton Dome with Imogen Heap. I went to the National Museum of Computing at Bletchley Park, where Alan Turing worked. I became part of the Alan Turing Centenary Committee to get him pardoned by the Queen, which was really, really cool. So I got involved in all those different things through my music. So it was, you know, that for me, that was like peak. I've done it. I can't do anything better than that, really. So I don't know if anybody knows this, but while I was working on my fourth album, lightning actually hit the side of my house, side of the building where I was. So I was working on it and I was backing up everything at that point in time. So I had the backup hard drive connected and the computer connected, and it all went, everything for the fourth album, which is kind of a blessing because I was just starting to do a lot more educational work, a lot more academic work, writing about how to use technology in a creative way to encourage people to get more confidence in themselves, go out into the world and make stuff. And so I kind of took that as a sign. I thought, I'm going to go away and I'm going to build this school and you can see what happens. I'm going to try an 8-week pilot, which is now its 12th anniversary of the school. So we've had alumni come through here who've worked on the latest Sonic games, who've worked on like Horizon Zero Dawn. Those kids have come through us. So it's really, really lovely that we have such a massive alumni. But when you are a creative person, unfortunately, it's like this burning thing that will eventually come back to you. And I kind of had to push music away. It's a really sad and horrible thing to do to yourself. But I took music and I just put it over there. I was like, I can't go on any of those adventures because whenever I do anything musical, I end up on the most insane adventures. Unbelievable stuff. I've met so many big celebrities and been invited around the house to these crazy parties. And it's like, I'm teetotal. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do drugs. I eat like Haribo, like gummy bears and cake. I am the most, you know, I'm just there. It's lovely to meet you, but I don't do any of that stuff. But I end up going on crazy adventures, essentially. So I had to kind of force music over there. And to do that, I forced myself to listen to 3 albums for 12 years. That's it.
Whoa.
That's how does one even do that?
That's like celibacy?
Yes. It's probably worse.
Well, what were the 3 albums?
Yeah, we have to know.
It's Prince Purple Rain.
Okay.
Black Crowes, Southern Harmony Musical Companion, and Taylor Swift, 1989.
Wow.
That's it. That's it. Can you handle those for 12 years?
No, I can't.
I know, but it was what I had to do. I had to stop myself from encountering new music. I had to prevent myself. Because if I mishear a part of music or hear a part of music incorrectly, my brain will construct the rest of it. It will just go, oh, add this, 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 and this, this. Like if I hear music in the other room and it's muffled, my brain will just go.
Interesting.
And then here's the rest of it. So it's really quite dangerous because I end up tinkering with things and messing around with things and I just forget other things because music is all encompassing. So it was very, very difficult. So it was very, very cruel of what I did to myself in that respect. But I had a responsibility to the children I was working with to build this school, to get it sustainable, to make sure that they could get their education. The first group of students I had knew I was pixel hate. The middle group, the middle years, didn't know anything about my music. Sir, you don't understand. It's a kind of music called chiptune and you don't understand it. And it's like, I think I know a little bit about it. And a lot of my students I have now are saying like, are you on TikTok, sir? I was like, I am. You make music. I was like, yeah, it's quite good. I was like, oh, thank you. And it's quite good. And these are SEN kids, a lot of them, special education needs kids. And they're all on the spectrum. They have depression, anxiety. They're afraid of the world. And we're just trying to get them to be a bit more confident in themselves, to go out and be who they want to be, do what they want to do, and use technology to help them with that. So I took it quite seriously. But unfortunately, I made a fatal mistake in that I took my son, who's about to release his own album, actually, which is going to be amazing. It's going to be absolutely amazing. So I took him to see Stop Making Sense by
Oh, that movie will change you.
Oh, my goodness.
Just a note here, because we were so excited that we reacted over Pixel Hate. That's Stop Making Sense, Talking Heads' landmark 1984 concert film directed by Jonathan Demme, widely considered to be the greatest concert film of all time. And fun fact, you can scroll back a couple episodes in this feed to hear my interview with Talking Heads' frontman, David Byrne. Anyway, Stop Making Sense changed my life the first time I saw it, and, well.
So I just sat there when they started singing, and the absolute joy of the musical performance and of the people on stage, I just thought, oh, God, I'm going to go back to music, aren't I? And, you know, so that happened, and I just kind of sitting in the audience thinking, I love what I'm seeing on the screen, but I just want to run out and just start recording music and start writing music. And so we went to see that film about 5 times.
Oh.
Yeah, it was really, really good for me, but there were a lot of tears. There were a lot of tears. And there has been a lot of tears all throughout this album. And then a couple of days later, I do a lot of security work for our government here in the UK, various things, let's just say. So I know a lot of really, really techie people. And I was just talking to this guy who works for one of the agencies, and he was repairing a hard drive that was hit by an explosive device. And it was in fragments. And he said, oh, I can bring anything back, mate. I can just lay it on the table, check it on the table. So I gave him my hard drive that was hit by lightning 12 years ago. And within 24 hours, he had recovered 80% of what I'd written.
Wow.
All these things happened within the space of about 3 days. Then the third thing was I contacted Imogen Heap, who is my fairy godmother. She looks after me. She taught me everything about the music industry. She's the most wonderful person. If you ever get to meet her and talk to her, you'll see what I mean. She's lovely, absolutely lovely. So she invited me to her house to meet loads of other musicians. And I took my son because he sent her some demos of what he was recording on. And we just went and I just sat down. And I felt weird because I was a musician and I was surrounded by musicians. And I had to decide kind of then, am I talking as a musician or am I talking as I was a musician to these people? And it kind of clicked in my head. I thought, oh my God, there's so many things saying you're going to go down this route now, Matty. You don't really have a choice. Your hard drive's fixed. You've got some time off over Christmas. You've got bloody Talking Heads in your head. You know, there's no escape from this.
That's
now.
You're a going different to go kind back. Of lightning bolt.
Yeah, it was, I described it as being hit by a ton of pillows. You know, it's just like, it was nice. It was nice, but there's no escaping from it. None whatsoever. It all hit me at once. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go back. I did get all the demos back on that hard drive, but I think it's good they were hit by lightning. If I'm honest, they were very much of the time and who I was hanging around, and they were slowly sounding more unlike me. And I was listening to too many other people and too many people's views on my music. I'd done some software for like Damon Albarn for Plastic Beach. And there were songs on my album, which I started to incorporate bass on. And then I listened to it and I thought, that's not me. That's being influenced. And that's okay. But I have to get back to absolutely who I was when I started as Pixel Hay. And with this album, I think I've gone back to, if it's not coming out of a chip, it's not going in my album, basically.
Amazing.
Now, what I did when all my music stopped is I actually gave away all of my equipment, every single piece of my equipment. It's like the Infinity Stones scattered across. Like, there's parts of it in Japan, there's parts of it in America. Every, you know, any chip tuner that asked me for anything, I was like, here, I've got one, you can have it. It's gone.
Yeah.
So I had to rebuild everything from scratch. So it was a matter of me very naughtily re-breaking into every console I've ever hacked into again and coming back. But along this journey, I learned how to do something which was just like, oh my God, where did I learn that? And I hadn't consciously thought of it, but we're experiencing what we call bit rot in tech. Essentially, things are slowly breaking down, like old media, old magnetic media, old consoles, the joints are drying up, everything's just stopping working because they weren't manufactured to the highest standards, really. They were quite terrible. So I was experiencing a lot of these secondhand consoles I was buying was just exploding And that was it. And it's just like, you know, I could resolder every joint in there and kind of work through it. Or I could just take out the sound chip and build a computer around it. So I just thought, okay, I thought I will get the sound chip and I will just put it onto an Arduino.
Oh, wow.
So essentially what I've done is I've got a 4 megahertz chip for the oscillator. I've got the sound chip and I've got an Arduino. And that is a BBC Micro. It's this huge, clunky British computer, massive thing that I used to have to take on stage. I can now fit into a Game Boy shell.
Amazing.
And once I learned how to do one, it was almost like you could do this with every machine. I can now take a Commodore 64 and fit it into a Game Boy shell. I can now take a ZX Spectrum, a NES, a SNES, all of them. So they're all massive machines that all needed a separate screen, separate power supplies, all of that, all USB powered, tiny little device I could fit into my hands. So my live setup went from being this 4-desk electrical nightmare, which anything could go wrong, into this really lovely briefcase I can just pop open and this rainbow of Game Boys pop up and I just play.
That's really neat.
And trigger off things through it. And it avoids all patents, all legalities, all those problems, all those kind of cease and desist letters, all of that stuff is now gone because I'm not evading their security. I've completely removed any security issues whatsoever. I'm just directly accessing the chip. I'm literally feeding bits into the sound chip brain. So this is the third wave of chiptune in that we're now saving the chips in these machines to carry on making music with them.
Wow.
I could go and buy broken machines and just harvest the chips from them and get them working again.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's a lovely thing to kind of come back and kind of do a reclamation of the computer chips.
So this new technique means you have a bigger arsenal of sounds at a fraction of the physical size. Is there anything different you can do with the sound chips themselves?
I can't do anything different with the chips that I couldn't do when they were inside the machine. So they can only do the same things, but they're a lot more friendly. They're a lot more reliable in terms of I can say, play this note and it'll play that note and the machine will explode. So that's where I am.
That's really cool.
I literally have a desk full of computer chips in front of me. Like these are arcade sound chips. These are like the ones they use in like Bubble Bobble and ZX Spectrums. And I literally have loads of them. I just
amazing.
It's kind of good and bad, I think, but that's who I am. Yeah. So
I love how much you use the Commodore 64 sound hardware. I grew up with a Commodore 64 and it has such a distinctive sound to it. It's really amazing.
The SID chips are the most brutal and nastiest sounding chips ever. And that I use that on Bitrot Nonstop for the bass. I use that on the Old Grey Missile Test. I use it on Disco Diskette for the bass. It is brutal. I can remember going around my friend's house in Germany. He had a Commodore 64. And we used to get his mum to load up a game at like 3:30 in the afternoon. So when we got home on the American school bus to his house, California Games was loaded. So we didn't waste any time.
Wow.
It was just like it was ready to go. It's a beautiful thing, but sadly, the SID chips are dying. They are actually slowly just dying and nobody makes them anymore. So luckily, some company has made clones of them to kind of move things forward so you can replace them with clones of them. And I think that's, you know, that's what's going to happen in the future. So one of the projects I'm going to do is make a huge sample library of lots of different things and just let people use them for whatever they want to. I don't care. But I think that's what I'll have to do. And it'll be a weird world to live in when we don't actually have any of those original working chips anymore. But it will happen. But it's nice to be here now to be a part of that. Part of the reclamation, part of the preservation of that kind of stuff.
Looking into the future and the present, we have Hard Reset, which is an incredible record that really showcases the scope and depth of chiptune music.
Some of the tracks on Hard Reset really kind of like hit me in the feels, like Plot Armor and Endgame Current in particular. It was evoking feelings of, you know, a larger narrative. I don't know if that was intentional for you to put that in there, but that's what I was kind of getting from it.
The thing about this album was, with any music, is I do a lot of thinking before I make the album. I do a lot of thinking. And when I was doing the Old Grey Missile Test, which in particular is highly amusing because I actually took apart a missile guidance system to make a synthesizer. Yeah.
Oh, you devil. I love this.
That track goes places too. It's wild.
Yeah. So when I was making it, it was originally 2 minutes and 43 seconds long. And I kind of felt it hadn't gone everywhere. As you say, it goes places. I felt it hadn't gone everywhere it needed to go. It was 2 minutes and 43 seconds. And I thought, well, if I make it any longer, it's going to be way longer than a normal chiptune song. And then I thought I could punch myself right now. Because I'm not making chiptune music. I'm just making music. And a song can be as long as it needs to be. So I thought, think about your favorite songs. Prince, Another Lonely Christmas. Any bloody Cure song goes on for hours. Yeah. You know, all of my favorite songs of dread and drudgery and all those things are about 4 or 5 minutes. Suede, The Asphalt World, beautiful song, goes on for like 7 minutes. Yeah. Perfect song. Why can't a chiptune song be 5 minutes long? I felt like people were watching me as I extended the track, but you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to try this out. And it just worked. And I thought, I'm not making a chiptune album. I'm just making music with chiptune instruments.
Yeah.
And that's what I went for on this album. That is where I am emotionally. That's where I am as a musician. I'm just trying to create interesting musical experiences. I'm not trying to fit into the chiptune genre because if I'm honest, a lot of the chiptune genre is quite boring to me. A lot of it is bass drum, bass drum, bass drum, bass drum. And it's like, well, it's boring. My music is all over the place in terms of the actual genre. The chiptune is more the instrumentation.
Yeah. It can't be ignored how much Hard Reset takes you on a journey through many different genres, like dance, industrial. There's like score pieces. Like, it is a very diverse album.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. I'm really, really happy with it. I kept saying to my family, annoyingly, I think it's my best album ever. And they were like, can we hear it? No. But I think it's my best album.
I also think it's your best album. I think it's wonderful.
You didn't let your family hear it? Why not?
This is going to sound maybe a bit distressing. I basically wrote it in headphones all day, and then I would listen to it in my car out loud so that way no one in the office here could hear it. No one would hear a single note of it. And if I would catch myself humming it, I would have to kind of like, oh, and then go out the room or something and just not let anybody hear it. The only person I did let hear it was my son when it was time to send it off to be put on CD.
Wow.
Because he's got better hearing than me. I wanted him to say, yes, all the levels are fine. You're not going to destroy somebody's setup with it. It'll be fine because he's really, really good at listening to things. He actually listened to it twice. He listened to it once in stereo and once in mono because he does all kinds of sound design stuff. So when he heard it and he said he really liked it and he said, I think it's your best album yet. I was like, see, I told you. And it was quite a nice experience to share with my son to let him hear it first. But
yeah.
I'll be honest with you, there was a lot of tears with this album. I sat in my car for quite a while just crying, kind of feeling bad about the fact that I pushed myself away from music, mm-hmm. kind of feeling bad that maybe I could have done this if I would have stayed in music or whatever. But it was kind of just being reunited with music and that whole spectrum of sound. It was very, very emotional. And I would go out on walks into town and listen to my music in headphones. And I walked into a supermarket and Old Grey Missile Test came on and I just burst into tears and had to walk out of the supermarket.
Wow.
Just like, I'm really happy I wrote that song, but I don't know, something about it, just emotional, I suppose, is the best way. I couldn't really describe it, but I was very happy and obviously crying at the same time. Mm-hmm. But the moment where I realized I think I've written a genuinely good album was when I wanted to put some music on in the car and I kind of thought about, you know, have that pre-thought of what you're going to listen to. And then you realize, oh my gosh, that's my song. I actually want to listen to a song that I wrote. And that sounds quite arrogant. But at the same time, I thought, that's quite nice. I don't think I've ever had that before. Oh. I don't think I've ever had that point where I've wanted to actually listen to my music for enjoyment. And that was for Superposition Save State. It was like, oh my gosh, I missed that song. I want to hear it again now. And that was a really kind of emotional thing to kind of experience.
That's so beautiful.
It's the best when you make your own earworms.
Yeah, it is good and bad. Because my brain at the moment is wired the way it is, essentially, if I hear just a part of a song, my brain will just write the rest of it around it, and then I can go into the studio and just go bruh, and it's done. I just kind of lay it out and it's done. And that can be really, really quite distracting a lot of the time. So I can wake up in the middle of the night, and some of my best ideas have literally, I'll wake up and not really lucid dreaming, but I'll have like all this bloody music playing in my head, and I'll literally have to go downstairs to the kitchen, close the door, and be as quiet as I can and hum it into my phone and then write it the next day because I will wake up with the music in my head. So it's tricky to manage.
Classic double-edged superpower, right?
I mean... Yeah, it is like that. I think it's going to be an interesting thing to manage over the future.
Hi, I'm Paul Whitehouse, and I'm here with Get Your Guide on the River Test, one of the most idyllic fishing spots in the country.
Escape to nature in the Hampshire countryside with Get Your Guide and spend the day with comedian and angling enthusiast Paul Whitehouse. Enter for a chance to win your spot at getyourguide.co.uk. Get Your Guide. Unforgettable travel experiences.
Sometimes running a business can feel like swimming upstream in Siberia.
Welcome.
With a bear clinging onto your leg. But Xero Online Accounting Software can help you manage the ins and outs of your finances in real time, so you can keep them running smoothly. Soon it will feel more like you're going down a water slide.
Your turn.
In a rubber ring. Or being serenaded by a string quartet. Search Xero with an X, because healthy business is beautiful business.
I'd love to explore a Hard Reset a little in depth.
Yeah, there's so many interesting sounds in it. It opens with like what sounds like a speaking spell.
Yes. I went so far back to try and recall the first memories I heard of electronics sounding really, really cool. And that was the speaking spell. I can remember going to this kid's house in America when I first moved over to North Carolina. And he had a Light Bright. I don't know if you remember Light Brights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Amazing things. You can't really have them today. They don't make any sense. And he had a speaking spell. And I just thought, this kid is so cool. When I'm older, I'm going to be like him. It only took me like 35 years, but now I've got a speaking spell and a Light Bright. So I'm good. I'm good.
Do you use like the Light Bright as like a sequencer?
Coming from England, we had conkers, like these like large like walnut things that come out of trees. And we drill holes in them and put them on strings and we hit each other with them. That was our toys in England. We went over to America and you had like all these gadgets and these things that talked and stuff. And I thought, this is so cool. And so I wanted to kind of re-experience that wonder of sound. So I had to get a speaking spell. And I did the same thing with the speaking spell. I harvested the phonetics in it because disco, party tech. Speaking spell can't say those words. But if you prompt it to say one word and then cut it off and then prompt it to say another word, and do that really, really fast, it gives you the phonetics. You're harvesting the phonetics to create those sounds.
Disco, biscuit, party tech, system check, 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 1, 2, 4.
Disco is Morris Day and the Time. That's where my influence was. I can imagine them sliding across the floor, playing on a keyboard and sliding back. That's where it came from. And then the chorus of it is Sly and the Family Stone. Those are the influence. I grew up on hip hop. I grew up on soul and funk music. So that was really, really good fun to do. Rainbow Black Rainbow, the more industrial kind of heavy hitting sound, that literally was designed to push air around a nightclub. So I turn on about 60 machines just to create a mains hum, like what we did, you know, you do at the beginning of recordings, so you create that silence. I had about 60 machines powered on to just capture that wave of like empty sound to make it push around it.
That's wild. It's a really heavy track. It feels good coming out of my speakers, but I'd love to feel that noise against my body, like coming out of a live venue sound system. Are you planning on doing any performances?
I've had so many students kind of like show up listening to my music. And so I'm going to do a gig, hopefully in my hometown, where my quote unquote normal fans and my students can show up. So it's an all age gig.
Nice.
And we've got a really good venue, which is going to be very friendly towards kids on the spectrum because it has like section spaces so they can go into a less dense space but still be part of it. So I'm going to do one or two gigs like that in Ipswich because I think it'll be quite good fun. A lot of live shows, a lot of festivals over here are like, ooh, it's electronic. That's a bit weird. That doesn't fit with anything else we've got at the gig. So we can't have you because you'd be too different to anything else. I end up now, I play at like ambient music festivals and I'm still on the edge of that because I'm not, right. I'm not really ambient music. But I said to the organizer, he said, I know I normally make kind of chiptune music, but I'm going to make ambient chiptune music just for the festival. I'm going to write a piece just for the festival because I think that would be more in fitting with it. But yeah, I don't know where I fit in, but I don't really care.
Well, question, do you think that that kind of rigidity is more present in the UK?
I think so. It's pretty much locked down. We have very, very strict genres of music, which is interesting because when you listen to a modern pop album, it's all over the place. Like, you know, you know, my son got me to listen to Harry Styles' album. I said, you know, that's just pop music written on weird instruments. That's all it is. It is just straight up pop music. It's all over the place in terms of it borrows from every genre. It borrows from everything. But if you are in one genre like I am, which is electronica, you can only play at electronica events. And those are so far and few over here. Like there's barely any gigs whatsoever. It's problematic, really. But what's happened for me in my career, or I can see happening again, is I played in my hometown in like the worst little pubs ever. Like, you know, the most violent, you will get stabbed, somebody's going to die in this pub kind of pub every time, right? Really rough pubs because they're the only pubs that would let us play. And they liked it. They thought it was all right. You know, that was fine. So I played in my hometown for like 2 years as Pixel Hate and like maybe two or three people showed up to the gigs, like for ages, like nobody would come. I then obviously get picked up as Image and Heap's opening act. I get in the press and then everybody starts like complaining. Why don't you play in Ipswich anymore? I was like, well, because nobody came. Literally, I could go out and sit in my own audience. Nobody came to the gigs. And I can see that happening again where I've pitched myself. Look, I'll come and play at your festival for free. And still they say, well, you don't really fit in with any of the other acts we have. So it's just like, well, I'm going to go away to London again. And in a couple of months' time, you'll call me up and I'll charge you an exorbitant amount of money to play. And it's really, really sad. It's really, really sad that I have very few fans in my hometown, probably about 10 or 20. But I go to London and I'll have loads of people who want to show up to the gigs, which is nice. You know, people are shocked that I'll do a gig for free in my hometown, but nobody will come.
I've heard that story from a lot of musicians, like a lot of folks out of like Pittsburgh, for example, would often come down to Orlando for shows because Orlando loved them. Austin loved them. Pittsburgh didn't give a shit.
It's interesting. It's I think my audience, it's not a bad thing to say this, but my audience is on TikTok. It's wild. It's like the Wild West of music at the moment. I think it's really, really, really interesting. I didn't expect to have that many people get on board. I've been on it like for 3 months and I've got several thousand followers and like it's just working out on TikTok. It's kind of like how MySpace was. I think people go on there and expect to be exposed to new music. I think that's the case. Well, that's been my experience of it. I've just been constantly hit with new music on it, which has been interesting. But there's nothing like MySpace anymore. It's all algorithms and, oh, you like this? Well, we're going to send you 7,000 posts about that. And it's just, it doesn't feel like the chaos that MySpace was. I really, really miss that, sadly.
Yeah, well, much to be said for beautiful chaos, whether it be in arcades or on web platforms.
Yeah. As a chiptune artist, I've experienced the kind of negative side of making music with video games. Oh, it's just silly music, isn't it? It's just nonsense music, what you're doing. It doesn't really make any sense, whereas in Japan, composers of video game music are revered because they are writing the soundtracks of so many people's lives and childhoods. And
absolutely,
writing video game music was frowned on a lot of times. My experience was that it was kind of frowned on, that it wasn't real music. And I find that quite interesting. My son was actually told the other day that he wasn't a real musician because he didn't play an instrument.
You know, yeah. I'm actually shocked that those conversations yeah. in the 90s, sure, people were getting over themselves, right? But like, we were evolving culturally. But I'm actually shocked that these are still conversations that are happening.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the case. The irony being is I'm the guest lecturer who goes into that university to give talks about music music industry. So I said, okay, that's fine. Don't go there. Wait till I go in and have another talk, and then we'll kind of set the record straight, because I'm quite upset that they held that view. But then also the other day, I applied to have like my music played on a radio show, because I'm technically unsigned. I'm not on a major label. I'm just an independent, so I can go on what we call unsigned shows or independent shows. And they said, oh, you can't be on our unsigned show because you don't play guitar. And I was like, I don't quite understand. What is it, just you're automatically going to be unsigned because you play guitar? How does this work?
Well, who's the judge of that too?
You don't play guitar, so you can't be on the unsigned show. So
would they not play an unsigned rap artist? I don't get it. Like,
no, I think that was the problem. And at the end of the day, it was just like, so you're not willing to accommodate any other type of music apart from guitar music. If that's the case, that's fine. That's, you know, your choice as a radio show. But you're labeled as an unsigned artist radio show. And I just was baffled. Just like, what does one have to do with the other? Yeah, it's quite interesting in that you have those kind of views still in music. Like that music that you do, Matthew, it's a bit weird. And it's not real music though, is it? And it's like they try to get you to admit, oh yeah, actually you're right, mate. I've been doing this for 12 years. It's not real.
Well, it's like, what would they classify it as? Would they call it programming? I mean, like,
I don't think they value anybody who doesn't play an instrument. Hmm. And it's quite upsetting because I can play everything. I can play guitar. I can play bass. I can play cello, piano, everything. I play drums. You name it, I can play it. I just don't want to. It's not something I'm drawn to. I'm drawn to kind of tinkering with wacky sounds and coming up with interesting stuff that way.
Matt, I'm pretty damn furious about that. That kind of rigidity is so regressive. Hey, more reasons to burn the institutions down, right? Get weird with it, humanity. You have nothing to lose but your chains.
So what can you tell us about track 3, Superposition Save State?
It's Kate Bush. That's where my inspiration came from that.
Amazing.
I love that title too. I love that name, Superposition Save State.
Well, I wanted to create that kind of uncertainty in a relationship. That kind of like, I've got a save state, so I should be safe, but it's a superposition. So have I saved it? Should I turn off the console? Am I okay to leave the room? Is this argument over or not? What's going on?
That's beautiful. Yeah. That's such a like Central World Red Shoes era Kate Bush emotional arc concept for a song. It's so good.
All of my songs start off as titles. They're ideas. They're usually some kind of joke or quirk that's to do with technology or something. I literally wrote down all the titles for the tracks. That's all I did. And then I wrote the songs to those ideas and I kept them in that order. And that's the album.
Now, on that notepad you just shown us, you also have some kind of color-coded bar system. What is that?
That's how complete they are.
Ah, okay.
Over time, so they start out in red when they're just a rough idea. So it's like an energy power bar, because I forget lots of things and I have a lot going on. So I just had that on my desk for 3 months and I could see where I was with every single song. And eventually all the power bars filled up, the album's done. And it was as easy as that. And my son thinks it's hilarious. He said, you literally just wrote the album down and then wrote the album. He's like, who does that? I was like, well, I just did it. I just did that. I thought these will be interesting ideas to explore, and then hopefully they'll fit together, and then they did. So, Old Grey Missile Test. So, I don't know if you know this, but I got involved in film recently.
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice on Wikipedia, like, the last note is that you were a priest in a film that came out last year called Gandhi Vihari Arjuna.
Yes, that's right. It was basically a bet with my son. He said, I bet you won't audition to be in this cast because they're filming it locally. And I said, sure, I'll do it. And originally I showed up and they said, okay, have you done any acting before? I was like, no. So, okay, just stand over there. You're going to be holding a book in the background. And then the director came up to me. He said, no, you're going to be the priest. And I was like, and so 12 hours later, after filming a Catholic funeral service, after delivering a full Catholic funeral service, I was in an Indian action movie, and it was hilarious. So I met loads of people, and I talked to loads of people on set, and I met loads of the armorers, the people who do all the guns and all the props. And then I ended up doing a TV show where I play a football manager in the 1980s, and I met another armorer there, just because he has all the cool tech and stuff like that. And I spoke to him and I said, oh, do you have like tanks and stuff like that? He said, yeah, I got tanks. I was like, have you got like missile launchers? Yeah, I got stuff like that. Do you have a missile guidance system?
He said, my God.
You might not believe it, but I actually do have a few parts of a missile guidance system because I used it in this film where, you know, they sit in front of it and they do this and that. I was like, do you need the insides of the missile guidance system? And he's like, well, no, it doesn't work. It's like, it's been decommissioned. I was like, well, until I've been into it, it hasn't been decommissioned. Mm-hmm. So I literally got some of the chips out of it. And then they weren't like super specialist chips and they can't do anything dangerous and there wasn't anything dubious about it. But they were fairly common chips. But I like the idea of taking chips from something that was made to do harm to people and turn it into something that makes music.
Yeah.
So it was just a simple waveform generator made out of chips from a missile guidance system for the Old Grey Missile Test. And obviously, It's a play on words for the Old Grey Whistle Test in the UK, the TV show. And I misspelt missile in the title on purpose. Loads of people said, oh, you've misspelt missile. I was like, no, I haven't. Actually, if you look on loads of the missile guidance test programs from America on the websites, they misspell it on there. So I wanted to highlight that the people in charge of testing the missiles have actually misspelled the word missile several times on like the test documents.
Wow.
So I just, I thought, that's weird. I'm going to use that.
Track is Digital Revenue 0.002.
I write a lot of puns in my titles, like Digital Revenue 0.002 was just to highlight how little musicians actually get paid when you play one of their songs.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised it got through Spotify because I pitched it to the editors. I literally pitched the album to the editors and said, listen to this album, ignore track 5. and just get it through. But people kind of like, wow, okay, I didn't realize that. I thought you get paid like loads. I was like, no, the music industry is so sewn up that like some people get paid and others get nothing. If I went online and put people's music online and didn't give them any money, I'd be done for piracy. If this organization does it, you pay a subscription.
Yeah.
I'm lucky though in my life that I don't have to rely on making money from music. Because I run a school, because I built a school. So that's my income. But it is the case that people who do genuinely want to pursue a career in music have an uphill battle in that respect. And it's a very, very challenging thing to get through.
Yeah.
So the next track, Bit Rot Nonstop, was about how we're slowly losing machines. And the way I did that was, if you listen to it, it's a loop. It goes over and over again, and it slowly decays over time. And essentially, I assigned all of the notes in the song values. and they basically fly by and get destroyed. There's a game called Mega Mania on the Atari 2600 where all these ships fly to the left and right and you can shoot them. And if you shoot them, it knocks out that note and replaces it with a noise. So originally it was just a pop song in it with the bass, and the song slowly gets destroyed more and more over time. I wanted to highlight that we are losing things.
That's so cool.
The one thing I've learned in my old age is that put the noise track later on in the album. And that is a very noisy track, because on my other albums, I put it like two tracks in or three tracks in, and you can see like a drop off of listeners right after that. And it's like, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve what's coming, basically. But then I thought, no, I'm going to put it slightly later on. Got to always have that kind of rage-inducing noise track, always. There is a lot of sounds on Bitrot Nonstop. You know, in a lot of anime, when they pull out of a sword and it goes pling like that. I was trying for about 6 hours to make that kind of sound with an S. And I just thought, I don't know why I want to do this, but I want to do it. And so it took me like 6 hours and I managed to get it to do it with an S.
And here's that sound.
2 seconds of a sample, which flies by in the destruction that is Bitrot Nonstop. I kind of felt good and bad about those 6 hours, making an anime unsheathing sound on a NES. I could have been doing this and this and this and the other, but I did that instead. But then I thought the product of those 6 hours was, one, I had a cool sound, and two, I really enjoyed it. And that's okay. It's nice to just go away and be alone and tinker with a creative process and not have to worry, is this going to make me loads of money? Is this going to pay the bills? It's just something that I have to get out of my head. And I don't know why I have to make that sound on that machine today, but that's what's going to happen. And until I've done it, I'm probably not going to eat, probably not going to do anything else, probably not going to answer any emails. And then it'll be done, and then no one will know about it.
Oh, you've described the neurodivergent experience in a nutshell.
It's also the shortest track on the,
the album. The more information that you put into a song, I don't mean like how many notes or how many words you put into it, but how much effort you put into constructing a song, it always pays off. It always pays off. Whenever you really think about stuff, it always kind of shows that you've thought about it in the end product.
I'm going to go back, listen to that track, and really savor the levels of it. It's one of my favorites, actually.
Thank you.
That and Plot Armor are probably like my top two.
With Plot Armor, that came about with a conversation with my son. I've explained to him that I've probably had about 20 near-death experiences in my life. Like, I've been in car crashes, I've been shot at, I've been kidnapped. I do go on adventures. So I try to avoid them if best. But
Lightning tried to get you, but it only got your hard drive.
Yeah, it only got my hard drive. Better luck next time. So he was like, you know, he said it in the nicest way. We were like literally driving home from the supermarket. And we were talking about it, and he's like, how aren't you dead yet? And I was like, it's because I've got Plot Armor. You know, my story isn't over yet. And we just kind of like, okay. Okay. And then I just thought, I'm going to write a song about feeling almost invincible. And I think that's kind of what a lot of people have taken from that. A few people have said they listen to it while they go out jogging, and it really, really kind of pushes them. And I was like, that's interesting. That's good. That's cool. I should use that for me.
The penultimate track, In-Game Current, carries over that chip-pop vibe.
In-Game Current, I just wanted something super saccharine, sweet, super happy. I wanted to kind of conjure up that Hip Tanaka kind of balloon kid kind of vibe with that.
And here's where we would talk about the final track, Checksum. But when we recorded this interview, we didn't anticipate we'd go through the album track by track and ended up getting sidetracked by another conversation before we got to it. Since that's the case, that'll be the song that we close this episode with.
Pixel 8, you mentioned that there are CDs of the album on the way. It's currently streaming on a number of platforms. Are you planning on any other physical media releases?
So when it came to people saying, oh, you've got to release this album on vinyl, I thought, oh, that seems weird. Because the first time you hear my music is the first time it's analog.
Yeah. Like,
because it's pure digital up until the point where it's played into your ear. And I thought, I don't know how I feel about that. But then I kind of thought, well, as long as I tell people it does sound different to the original intention, that'll be okay. And so I'm going to get it done on vinyl. It's going to be bright, hot pink vinyl. It looks beautiful. And I just thought, as long as I tell people that. And then I thought, well, if it's on vinyl, I can scratch it. So, so I can do other more interesting things with it as well. So I'm okay with it. As long as people realize that if they want to hear it as I kind of intended, it's like pure digital form, then, you know, digital is the way.
You have to go down to the electronics store, get some Arduinos, and then, you know, solder some sound chips onto it, and then play it through, and then that's the authentic sound.
That's the authentic sound. I've been tempted in the past to release, like, a game cartridge of sound, but I just thought that kind of limits the way I do chiptune, because a lot of chiptune artists will focus heavily on one machine, whereas I have the arcade mentality where I can access any of the 300 machines I've got and chuck them on the album. So it's I want that kind of chaos.
I recently picked up this little doohickey super MIDI pack.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I've been playing
that's
around
really
with
good.
This. So it just plugs into my SNES that I played on as a kid growing up. And then I can, it's got a USB port so I can interface it to my DAW. And it's just like, it's been very interesting playing with that.
I did look at that, and I did kind of look at 16-bit sounds, and the problem I had with it was that it was a lot of sample-driven, and I kind of felt odd about that. There was just something too complex about it. I was just like, oh, but then we're heading towards making any sound.
From what I understand about the SNES or Super Famicom audio hardware, back when most consoles were using some kind of electronic synthesis, the SNES was really kind of groundbreaking in just how much it relied on samples.
Yeah. And it gives it all the games a very, very unique sound. It really does. I probably will use it in the future because I love a game called ActRaiser. Which is, I actually translated that for UK markets, the translation.
Really?
Japanese.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So,
that's so cool.
It's, when it first came out, nobody could play it. Everybody wanted to play it, but then I rewrote the manual and all the things into English. But yeah, ActRaiser has brilliant sound in it. So I will look at it. I'll see how I feel about it. I just don't know if I want to go down the sample route. I'll have to think about it. That's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
It's a pretty extreme rabbit hole.
Yes.
So you've recently announced that your next project is something called The Story of Love, a concerto for handheld device.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, I can tell you that I can't use the word Nintendo Game Boy. But essentially, it is me versus an orchestra using a Game Boy. I'm on Game Boy, and we have a lovely, huge orchestra playing very simple but interesting music to play along to. It's about me, I am the Game Boy, and the orchestra is my wonderful partner. It's a story of love.
But you've styled it you versus the orchestra. Why is that?
Yeah, because in the beginning it was quite quite chaotic, as all good relationships are. But it all ended up all right in the end. So
wonderful. Yeah.
And I think it will draw people in from the chiptune electronica world, and I think it will draw people in from the more traditional world into electronica. So it'll throw those two together. I started the first notes in 2009 and I just like put it in the drawer, and now I'm coming back to it because I heard, see, this is the problem. I hear a bit of the music and then my brain just goes, oh, you should probably do this and then this, and here's about 30 other pages of music you should write. And it's like, okay. So it's quite expensive to hire an orchestra to rehearse and to record. That's okay. I'm applying for funding. If we don't manage to get the funding, we're going to steal an orchestra. Me and my friend have a plan, and it will happen regardless of us getting funding or not. We'll manage to find an orchestra. I'm writing it so it's interesting enough that a professional orchestra will take it seriously, but simple enough that school orchestras can also use it.
Neat.
They can download the Game Boy ROM, press a button on it, and it'll perform all the Game Boy parts while the orchestra plays along to it. Because I found it quite shocking that schools have to actually license the music to perform in their schools. And I wasn't cool with that. I'm not cool with that at all. So I thought, if I make a piece of music that's going to engage them with chiptune music, but also with their more traditional instruments, then I think if I can make it so that it's playable by a novice as well, then we might be able to get more performances out of it. I think it would be wild if I saw a school play this piece of music. So yeah. I did do a song on my last album called You Were Born to Save the World.
One of my favorites.
Well, I used the orchestra, but I really wanted to kind of expand it a lot bigger because I really love orchestral music, concert music. I don't listen to the kind of orchestral music I'm going to write. I listen to like Penderecki and the Getty and like really horrible, scary stuff like Schoenberg and Bartok and like miserable stuff. But the music I'm writing isn't that. Like, I listen to the Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima. You know, that's
well,
a banger.
Yeah, that's
you
a
know,
heavy
that's,
one.
That's a beautiful piece of music, but I'm not going to write that kind of music. That's certainly inspired me to kind of look at music on that scale. And again, it's that whole idea of I'm not writing chiptune music. I'm writing music with chiptune instruments. And that's a whole different mentality. It's like, where else can I go with this now that I've got that mentality? And it's often very strange when you realize that you've had a certain mentality towards something, like, and then you kind of step back from it and think, oh, I was a bloody idiot for about 20 years. I could have had this much wider view on things if I would have just stopped, shut up, and moved back a bit and thought, oh, I'm actually a musician. I'm not just an electronic musician. I'm a proper musician, if you like.
Well, it's hard when the whole world's trying to keep you down like that.
I know. But if I could bring an orchestra to my little town just to perform this weird and wacky music, I think that would be quite a considerable eye-opener for people. Because in our town, we don't have really anything. Like, it's like a truck stop on the edge of nowhere. So if we could have an orchestral performance in this town with electronic music, I think that would be quite a significant thing. I don't want to write it and then go off to London and have it performed because it wouldn't be as good of an experience for me and for the people who I want to hear it. Yeah, but we'll see. If I'm in the news for stealing an orchestra, you'll know why.
That's the high story that I want to see made.
Yeah.
It's sort of a Robin Hood thing, really.
Yeah, I'm going to have to learn how to steal a bus and or drive a bus and then like somehow trick the bus driver to get off and then swap all the music sheets in some kind of 80s heist movie situation. And then
it sounds like a Muppets plot.
Yeah, it'd be great. It'll work out. If we had the Muppets involved, it would work out every time.
Totally.
They have plot armor.
They do.
Now, Matt, you mentioned that your son is putting out a record as well. What can you tell us about that?
I can say that I am absolutely super excited about my son making an album. His bedroom was my former studio. So he grew up with all the gadgets that remained. His childhood was full of me and his mother starting songs and letting him finish them. So we had lots of musical games. Our house is quite musical. We probably got several hundred instruments around the house. So it was inevitable that he would get involved in music in some way. He is very much making pop music, like straight up pop music. And it's really well written and it's annoyingly good. You know, when you hear people and they're really talented and you just think, oh. And I'm not just saying that because he's my son. I was very lucky to kind of take some of his music to Imogen Heap and say, this is my boy. This is what he's doing. I feel really old. And she was like, it's really good. And I was like, I know, right? And she's like, and he's only 14. Oh. I was like, I know. It's like, he sounds like he's about 22 with loads of life experience. But all he does is learn systems. He saved up his pocket money for 3 years to buy Ableton. And he's built his whole persona, because we will sit up late at night and we decided, if you go out there and you be yourself, when you see messages online like saying I hate so-and-so, you might take that on board, even though you don't know that person. Subconsciously, on some level, you're going to take that on board. So if we create you a persona, you have that kind of buffer. I've got Pixel Hate, and Pixel Hate goes on adventures and gets in all kinds of trouble, and I can just say, "Ah, oh, that was Pixel Hate." That's different. So we had those kind of conversations. We had conversations around, when are we going to release the album? Because I'm releasing mine in March, and I'm probably going to do this next orchestral thing next year. So we're having these kind of almost ridiculous conversations about scheduling our albums in our house, because I'm going to be there to help him promote it. I'm going to be there to drive him to all the places to promote it. So it has to be out of the way of the other stuff I'm doing. So it's been really quite interesting to kind of have those conversations with me about, what if the album's a success? What if the album's a failure? You know, how are we going to approach that? How are you going to deal with that? And we have to be prepared for both. We have to be prepared for it being a moderate success, you know,
right?
And all the feelings that go with it. And I explained to him, like, when you do a gig, you have a weird kind of high feeling about it. And after, you can get what we call like the post-Monday blues.
Drop.
Yeah, you feel that huge drop. And I kind of said, luckily, I never got involved in the world of drugs or drinking or anything like that. It's much worse for people who do. And he's completely teetotal. He's not interested in it either. But I said, we have to kind of find other things for you to do. So it's a gradual drop down from that. So if you do a big gig, then you need to try and do some other fun thing, like go out with your mates and celebrate and do this, this, and this. Go do something else. So it's not a steep drop. Because when I did gigs, if I did a really good gig, the next couple of days, which is like dreadful, I was like horrible to be around. And so I want him to learn from my experiences. And I was like, I wasn't a massive artist at all. And it wasn't like, you know, massive gigs I was doing, but still you have that emotional high when you do a gig. So you have to be prepared for all these different things. So we're having lots of conversations about how to proceed, how to get this album out there. All I can say is he won't let me listen to the album until it's done. But I know it's going to be good, because I heard his demos. And I said, oh, that sounds brilliant, brilliant. And he looked at me and was like, that's just a demo. okay, fine. That was really, really good. It was really, really good. And we've padded out his room, so he's got all the kind of sound padding so he can sing. And we all have to go out of the house on regular schedules and be out of the house all day so he can just let rip. And his friends think that's wild. His friends are like, what, your parents like help you support you do that? Like, yeah. Like, well, yeah, of course we are going to do that, because we're all musicians. We know that that's what we all need to do. We need to be away from other people and just focus. So I'm very excited about it. He's very happy with it. He started to think about, okay, how am I going to now perform some of these songs live? How am I going to perform them as a stripped down set, like with an acoustic guitar? Because I said, you can't be unsigned if you don't play guitar.
Right.
So all of those things, but it's going to be pop music. He listens to David Bowie, listens to Prince, he listens to Harry Styles. He's quite androgynous in his style. So it's going to be really, really interesting going forward. It's going to be really, really good.
That's awesome.
I know I sound like a proud dad, but I haven't even heard it yet, but I know it's going to be fun. And it's going to be an interesting experience. And I said to him, got to bear in mind, your father is going to be the only man that wants you to succeed further than him. There's going to be a lot of people in the industry who are going to try and drag you down. We just have to prepare you for that. We have to prepare you for that. Because originally, he didn't want to be the performer. He didn't want to be on stage. But Imogen says, no, your vocals pulled me into the song. You're that good. And slowly but surely, we kind of said, well, if you record an EP, then more people will want to, you know, use your songs and record songs with you. And then he got more and more into it. And we went to see Talking Heads too many times. And then there we go. We're at that point where he's about to sign up to do some live gigs. And we're looking at an album release around June time. Fantastic. Which is going to be, yeah, really, really good fun. And now, like, then we just have to work out when the other kids are going to release albums. Luckily, they're not the kind of musicians who want to record albums, because it can be quite a costly experiment to kind of put out an album. Yeah. But I'm very excited about hearing the album, and I'm probably here right before it gets sent off.
As is tradition in the household.
Yes.
Now, we've been talking a lot about upcoming stuff, but before we go, let's backtrack a little bit. You spent the last 12 years building an incredible sounding school. What can you tell us about it?
The school has gone from strength to strength, and it's been recognized by the UK Parliament. We're the only recognized UNICEF alternative provision in the UK. All of like the resources and the lesson plans that we create, we share with UNICEF so they can use them all over the world to teach other kids. We've done lots of workshops online with kids all over the world to teach them technology skills. I've won a BAFTA for the school.
It's awesome.
I got nominated 3 times for this award. And on the third time, I thought, oh, it's just taking the piss now. I literally showed up with hoodie and jeans and my pink Converse. I didn't even dress up. I just thought, look, you invited me. I'm going to show up. Me and my son are going to eat everything. And we're just going to lounge around. And then I bloody won. And so I had to go on stage and accept the award from the head of Atari. And I was like, oh, yeah, cool. And he was like, didn't make much of an effort then. I was like, well, I did the other 2 times. But I just like thought this is just a joke this time. So that was quite fun. Now that I've got my album out of the way, we're going to turn upstairs into a much bigger music studio for them now, a space where they can work on their music. I will show them how to use the hardware and everything, but I won't teach them how to write music. I don't want to curve the way they want to make music just because I make it in a certain way. I want them to make the music they want to. So it's quite nice to have music a part of both parts of my life now.
Yeah, that's so great.
Since the Nerdy Show site is currently down, be sure to check this episode's description on whatever podcast platform you're listening on for links to listen to Hard Reset and other important stuff we've mentioned.
Pixel 8, where should folks look for you out in the digital realm?
I'm pretty much everywhere, but bizarrely, I'm mostly on TikTok, Pixel 8 Music. I'm on Instagram as well. If you want to hear more of my music, it's best to go on TikTok at Pixel 8 Music.
And actually, there's something new that Pixel 8 has launched since this interview was recorded, a project called Alterniverse, music for retro games that don't exist in our reality.
So, soundtrack songs from fictional games from another universe, where each track is composed entirely on the sound chips of a specific game console.
Like Storms of Arcadia, an adrenaline-fueled sci-fi shooter for the Sega Mega Drive, Kaze no Uta, a Japan-only Game Boy release, and The Haunting Scarlet Mansion for Super Nintendo.
Pixel 8 is releasing a track a month for the next 12 months via his recently launched Patreon.
Personally, I'm really excited to see what he does with the sampling capabilities of the SNES.
Heck yes, big same.
Hear the songs and help support the creation of his work at patreon.com/pixelhate. That's Pixel H8.
This has been incredible, Matt. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having a chat.
Hard Reset is out now wherever you stream music. Physical media is on the way. Again, links in this episode's description. And when will another Nerdy Show episode appear? Who can say? We go wherever the muse takes us. But in the meantime, you can find all our latest happenings on Mother, She Wrote, the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program, on our Patreon at patreon.com/nerdyshow.
And we're always hanging out on the Nerdy Show and Omniverse Discord. Head to omniverse.media/discord. Taking us out is Checksum by Pixel 8.
Bye, I'm Kat.
Bye, I'm Jess.
Snarf. Are we doing Snarf? I was doing Krang.
Oh, blah.
A new file.
That's probably the same voice actor.
Only one way to find out.
IMDb.
Let's place their lines on top of each other's animations.
Snarf,
and see
what
snarf. Shredder, snarf, snarf.
All right.
Oh, gosh.
Hooray.
Sometimes running a business can feel like cycling uphill with square wheels.
Underwater.
But Xero Online Accounting Software can help predict the future cash flow of your business, so you can stay one step ahead. Soon it'll feel more like freewheeling downhill.
Woohoo!
On a tandem.
All right, mate.
With a masseur on the back.
Oh, that's nice.
Search Xero with an X, because healthy business is beautiful business.